I'd like now to introduce Emily Rapp. She is a writer and teacher. She is author of the forthcoming book. It hasn't come out yet, but it is available for pre-order on Amazon. It's called The Still Point of the Turning World. And she is doing a benefit for families with children who have Tay-Sachs disease and similar illnesses this Saturday, September 22nd, from 2 to 5 at Back Road Pizza here in Santa Fe. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this is a wonderful book that you wrote because your son has this disease, Tay-Sachs disease. First of all, what is this illness?
Tay-Sachs disease is caused by a missing enzyme. And what happens then is that the brain is not able to process the appropriate lipids. And essentially, the brain shuts down slowly. So it's often been described as Alzheimer's for babies, is one way that people talk about it. So the children slowly lose all their functionality and at some point are unable to eat. And then decisions have to be made in terms of whether or not to extend life with medical intervention. So 2.5 to 3 to 4 years is the lifespan for most kids with Tay-Sachs without intervention.
And this is something that, as you write about in your memoir, is so horrible and harrowing a diagnosis to get that it's very, very hard for people to live with. And there's this whole question of, I mean, it's in a way, it's almost harder for the parents than for the child, him or herself.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think it's obviously a parent's worst nightmare. And it's also a sort of uniquely hideous disease in the sense that your child develops to a particular point and then regresses. So it's like, what's going to come next every day? I think what's great about the organization, National Tay-Sachs and Allied Diseases, the organization that supports these families, is that right away when you join, they hook you up with parents who've been through this kind of experience. The first day I joined, I got about 55 phone calls from women all over the country who just lent their support. And you know, through this experience of parenting Ronan, it's clarified some of my ideas about what human life is about. It's very epic. And he's great company. And it is what it is, that kind of thing. It's been an incredibly difficult learning experience. I can't say that I would want to do it if I were given the choice again, but I don't regret it.
One of the things that is so interesting about the book is that you talk about, I mean, here you were, a young mother, married, great job, great friends, health, beauty. I mean, it's just a lovely life. And this child comes into your life and you'd been reading 173 parenting manuals as everybody in this generation seems to do and had all these ideas about the future. And then, what was it, 9 months into his life, you got this diagnosis and realized that there is no future, and that changes everything about how you see parenting.
It changes everything. It changed not only the way that I see parenting, but the way that I see the world. So early on, I decided that the only way to sort of handle Ronan's diagnosis, which was obviously the worst thing that's ever happened to me, was to sort of make my world really big by reading, by going out. And so for the first sort of 5 months of his diagnosis, I was sort of careening around town in my big fugue of grief, sort of bursting into tears in public places. And interestingly enough, many of the people who've helped me organize this, who've become really close friends of mine, are people I met in the wake of his diagnosis, people who really sort of reached out to me as friends. And so I'm really thankful to Santa Fe for that. I don't know if I would have this kind of community if this hadn't happened. I don't know. I didn't know that many people when he was diagnosed. And now I feel like I know amazing people who've totally ushered me through this experience. So yeah, it's parenting is in this modern world is like the Olympics, you know, it's like whose kid is smarter and which preschool, and oh my gosh, my kid's outpacing yours. And it's more about the parents than it is about the kid. I mean, people often say, oh, I really want to have a baby. And it's like, well, do you want to have a person? Because like, it's not a couch, you know? So it did make me kind of, not so much intolerant, but it made me really rethink some of the parenting messages that I'd gotten, which is sort of like, you know, make your kid the best. And, you know, all the messages that we get when we're
right.
kids. Yeah.
Well, one thing I really have noticed is it's when I was a kid and the way parents are with kids now, I mean, that's us, right?
Right, right, yeah.
Parents of today's kids. It's a very, very different set of expectations. And I find myself wondering if the total erosion of the safety net makes parents so afraid that if their kid isn't the best, that it's going to fall through the cracks altogether.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I learned from, I mean, certainly, yeah, when I was a kid, I used to come home from school and then leave the house, and no one asked me where I was going because people assumed I'd be fine and be on my roller skates and be all right. I think you're right. I think the safety net in this country, we don't really have much of one. And when you have a kid with a terminal illness, you realize that you just have the moment. And actually, that's true for every parent. You don't know what's going to happen to your kids when they go to a movie, when they go to high school. I mean, all of these things that have happened in our country and around the world. And actually, it's a lesson that the parents in a lot of the world know. They know that it's their children could die of violence or great poverty. And those are things that, you know, I was very aware of when Ronan was first diagnosed, that, you know, we live in this country where people just say, oh, that's against nature. That shouldn't happen to babies. It shouldn't happen to kids. But there are sick and dying kids everywhere because they're humans. And, you know, obviously human life gives rise inevitably to a precariousness. But nobody really wants to acknowledge that, right? In death is life, in life is death, that kind of thing.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like we have, our advanced society has made so many things possible, like women tend not to die in childbirth. There are exceptions, but not the way they used to.
Yeah.
And we tend to survive childhood, which I'm quite sure I personally would not have.
Yeah, me either.
Without antibiotics and things like that. And so we kind of have an assumption that if something goes wrong, that there's something morally wrong with it or it's somebody's fault.
Yeah.
Whereas the truth is, and it's built into a lot of religious practices and cultural practices, is death is with us all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really hard, I think, for Americans to cop to or to recognize. You know, Judith Butler is a thinker I really admire, and she wrote a book called Precarious Life, which sort of explores the public mourning rituals that happened after 9/11. And how that was the first time that our country really was like kind of collectively rending their garments, and how that was so strange for us to see. Of course, in the context of like, now let's go to war. But and she was just saying that a lot of other cultures have these rituals of mourning. And I definitely felt after Ronan was diagnosed that, I mean, I let it rip around Santa Fe. I just couldn't keep it in. And the response I got was mostly compassionate, sometimes a little bit like, what's wrong with that woman? But I found that really liberating. To have witnesses,
yeah,
even if I didn't know who they were. And I think it's something that we're so careful in this country to sort of not show these extremities of emotion, although we feel them. And so there's this kind of repression, I think, of those rituals that is incredibly cathartic. There's a reason why they exist.
Well, there's also, there are very beautiful passages. I mean, you were already a writer when you got this diagnosis, and so you, after a certain period, started writing, and the writing is very deeply felt and very beautifully crafted.
Thank you.
And there is this sense of living from day to day and being with your child, which I think a lot of parents, and indeed just a lot of people, could really learn from.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hope that the message of the book is that none of us knows what's going to happen. Like, I could leave here and get hit by a bus. That probably won't happen.
God forbid.
No. But that could happen. And so we really only have these moments with our kids. And parents know that, I think, instinctively in some ways, because the kids grow up so fast. You know, that's the old saying, oh, they grow up so fast, and you only have these moments with them. But that's true no matter what the age of your child might be. So, yeah, I think that is was a huge lesson for me. And believe me, I didn't want to learn it. So it was some hard going there. And it still is, obviously. It's an incredibly intensive emotional experience to be Ronan's mom.
Now, you had gone to divinity school.
I had.
By the time Ronan was born, you were no longer a believer?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I went to divinity school, and I studied mostly Christian theology. And I have to say, it really helped me write this book, because so many of those early theologians and current theologians are such deep, thoughtful people who sort of made their worlds really big. And what I always loved about theology was that it was a mix of sort of history and literature and philosophy and everything. And when I was writing this book, which I did sort of in a hypergraphic, unstoppable fugue of writing, was I just tried to read everything I had read to see if I could make some sense of this. You know, I was like reading Hegel's big book, you know, doorstop of a book, because I just thought, maybe he knows something. He made graphs. Like, he must know.
Hegel as nerdy, which
he's
I
such
love.
A nerd. And that helped me. And it's one thing that I often say to my students is that cultivating an inner life, which I had done in divinity school, but before that as like a big nerd, essentially in the library, is it really saved me. because it gave me a pool of inner resources to go to and say, what did C.S. Lewis say about grief? Or what are these early stories in the Bible that have to do with life and death and these epic stakes in a story or whatever? So I'm so glad I went to divinity school for that reason, if maybe that's the only reason. But the sort of deep intellectual questioning was one of the things I learned in divinity school, and I was thankful for it because it gave me moments of a refuge when I was really, really struggling at the beginning, the first year of his diagnosis.
Talk more about what you read, what you went back to that was helpful, because there was a lot of reading that turned out to be really, really unhelpful as well.
I read The Magic Mountain probably like 3 times, which is one of my favorite novels, just because it's so weird and funky and smart and epic. I did read a lot of Hegel. I would read my old papers. I reread Nietzsche. I reread Carson McCullers, who's
Nietzsche
one of my...
was helpful.
Nietzsche was helpful. You know why? Because he's so sarcastic and he's just like, whatever morality, you know, he just kind of, his writing style I thought is really energetic. And so it was kind of, it was like brain gymnastics as a huge form of distraction. I found this great big book about Akkadian myths that was about, you know, Gilgamesh, the early Adam, these precursor stories from the Bible that are about the biggest questions of human existence. Why do people die? Where do they go when they die? And those were the things that I was preoccupied with. So I read a lot of really weird books about the afterlife, which some of which were sort of less helpful than others. And I went back to books that I loved for the sake of language. Carson McCullers. I read so many Sylvia Plath poems. I mean, good Lord, I think I read her collected poems 50 times through, in a part because, I mean, all the writers that I picked have moments in those, in their works, where they sort of, it's like a blaze of emotion, especially like Sylvia Plath being the prime example of that, where there's so much necessity behind the work. And I was feeling that way about writing, so I wanted to read those things. And I read Frankenstein again, which is a big part of the book, sort of the creation myth revised yet again, which is what Mary Shelley was doing with that book. So yeah, I read a lot, and in bits and pieces. And I mean, I do think I read The Magic Mountain like 3 times, which is a big book. So I was busy, but it helped me. Yeah.
We're talking to Emily Rapp about her book, The Still Point of the Turning World. It is interesting because a lot of people, I think, turn to religion when times are hard and turn away from it when times are good.
Mm-hmm.
And the way a lot of people interpret that, especially people who are non-believers, are that, well, religion is just a crutch and it's just magical thinking that people need when mm-hmm. they're in a state of desperation. But the way you describe it, it's much more than that. It's actually deeply addressing the fundamental questions of life.
Yeah. I mean, I think that part of the problem with the way that especially Christians are perceived in this country is that it's merged with this kind of political platform that isn't necessarily true to the principles of the Christian religion. I mean, my parents are very Christian. They're very pious. They believe in Jesus. They believe in heaven. And they're not idiots. And they're incredibly caring. And they use that as a kind of tool, not as a crutch. So I think there's a difference. Like, they're not pouring out all of their sort of emotional whatever. They're not asking religion to solve anything. And that's really what religion is meant to do. It's meant to act, people are meant to come together and act as witnesses for other people's pain. And that's the thing I think we have trouble with in this country, is that religion suddenly has become a way of fixing, quote, fixing problems, social problems, moral problems, whatever, however you define it. But one of the things I found so comforting about being in communities of grievers, or just communities of friends, and still do in this situation, is that I don't want a solution, because there isn't one. I just want a witness. I want someone to be able to witness my experience. And that's what religious communities were designed to do, not to you know, direct people like sheep down a particular path. So, yeah, I definitely think that I'm not religious myself, or I don't identify with a particular religion, but I understand why people do it. It makes a lot of sense.
And then there's the other part of it, when you talk about a lot of the things you've read, is the practice of art. And there's a great quote that you have by Kurosawa, the Japanese filmmaker.
Yeah, to never avert one's eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. The artist is the person who never averts
one's eyes. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, art was very helpful. I mean, obviously, writing helped me move through this. I mean, I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't been able to write this book. I think I probably would have lost my mind, frankly. I mean, it was the thing that helped me get up in the morning, was to be able to sit with Ronan and write about him and feel like I was creating something out of a situation that seemed so medieval and abominable to me that almost, you know, still I sometimes can't believe it's happening. But I had to make something out of it. And I think that's a very artistic impulse. And it's one that, it's primal. I had a lot of friends who sort of worked their feelings about Ronan into their artwork. And that passage about the shining room, a friend of mine made an art installation of just sort of yellow paper. And you walk in and out of this room and it's like a room of wonder.
We were talking about this before we went on the air, and maybe this is something that you could read, because it speaks to this whole question of when you have a situation like this and you're a writer, you make a narrative out of it. And we, I think all, this is something that, I mean, September 11th just passed several days ago, and I think a lot of people, mm-hmm. the way they dealt with September 11th and the way they deal with whatever the trauma is in their life is they make it into a narrative and then they can live with it because they have a story.
Right.
And you have done that with this book. But there's also this thing that you wrote that spoke to not having a narrative.
Yeah. I'll just read. Should we read that paragraph?
Yeah.
Okay. I allowed myself to imagine Ronan in a landscape of light and continuous revelation. His life lived as a series of singular moments. I wondered if in some ways the greater loss here was mine, not Ronan's. Yes, Tay-Sachs disease would take his life. The number of his days was determined long before he could make a decision to transform the life he'd been given in one direction or another. He was denied that, but I couldn't imagine that his world was so remote, so unknowable. In this short story of his life, I could not believe that he had been denied wonder. What if every moment of Ronan's life was, for him, like stepping free into a space, into a first, into a state of wonder. Wonder that exists outside and beyond narrative. Wonder that feels like entering again and again, for the very first time, a shining room.
We're talking to Emily Rapp. So this is a question, again, getting back to when a child that young, I mean, infant, gets sick like that, and of course you give him the best care that he mm-hmm. can possibly get and make him as comfortable as he can possibly be. We can extrapolate from this book quite a lot about what your experience is like, but what is his experience like?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. That's one of the things that is both haunting and sort of weirdly comforting to me in some ways. Because he cannot articulate it, and his cues, his physical cues, are so subtle, I don't really know what his experience is like. I mean, I definitely know when he's uncomfortable, because I've learned, myself and his father have both learned to figure out when he needs something. But I don't know. He's a mystery to me in some sort of deep, profound way. And people have asked me, it's funny, because I have a friend who's like, he looks like he can see. And he's blind. He can't. But who knows? I mean, that's one of the things that is, who really knows? And that is a good question. I certainly don't think that the bulk of his experience is incredibly pleasant, because Tay-Sachs is a really difficult disease. But a lot of people have said to me when they're around him, they feel really peaceful because he's only in the moment. Like, he has no past, no future, and no anxiety, because he doesn't have the sort of cognitive development to do that. And that's pretty fascinating.
And you describe moments in your own life of a kind of peace and mm-hmm. happiness being around him, despite the fact that you're in an obviously difficult situation.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like, I certainly feel like the grief I have about Ronan is deeper than any grief. I mean, it's the deepest feeling I've ever had of pain. It's the deepest pain feeling I've ever had, emotional pain. But with that comes, I think, a greater capacity to experience joy. So I feel like the moments of joy that I have are like off the chart, just like the moments of grief that I have are sort of like stepping into a trap door and just like falling and never really hitting the floor. So there's an extremity that comes with extreme emotion. And, you know, I'm thankful for the joy parts, because they come out of nowhere, because that helps me survive the sort of the plummet, frankly. So I think that's a lot of people who've written about grief, C.S. Lewis probably the best or the most articulately, he talks about that, just being like in a state of absolute euphoria sometimes, remembering his dead wife. And then, you know, at the end of the night, he's sort of like out in the garden scratching in the dirt, like weeping. So I think it's both of those things. And people, it's a huge polarity between those two experiences, but it's also very human. I mean, if we live long enough, we all die, but we also lose people, and they change or they leave, or, you know, there's such a precariousness to our life. And it's when you realize that, it actually is an incredibly liberating feeling.
Yeah. And it's funny, and it's not comparable, but it's the only thing, as a kind of ridiculous animal lover, it's there's a kind of much fainter but still similarity to it, because the animals that you have in your life, they're never going to get any smarter.
Yeah, that's so true.
You know, they're never going to really change. They're completely in the moment, and you're going to lose them.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will see that to the end of their life. That's totally true. I mean, I think, and I also think, you know, people often say to me, "Well, I don't know what you're going through because I've never lost a child." And I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't think grief is not quantifiable, right? There's no hierarchy of suffering. If there was like a grief Olympics, like who would want to win that, right? I mean, but I do think people assume that like losing a child is the worst, and then, you know, losing your pet fish is like not that bad. But you don't know who's losing the pet fish. You don't know. I mean, people might get a zit and feel sad. Who knows? Like there's no ladder of suffering. There's no one that can say I suffer more than you. And that game is sort of it doesn't make any sense. It's not very human. It's a distancing maneuver, I think.
Well, one thing that I think is really important is that, I mean, even in this country, up until, a few generations ago, people were always losing their children.
Oh,
that was a part of life. Yeah. And it's like you've got, in a way, more in common with 18th and 19th century women than with your own peers.
I always knew I was in the wrong century. No, I mean, I think, you know, I worked as a relief worker in my early 20s and was in Africa a lot and saw a lot of women lose their children. Or in the grief moment after their children died of things like, you know, diarrhea. So I'd seen that. And when Winona was diagnosed, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because we were driving back from Albuquerque and I remember thinking, I am so glad that I saw that. I mean, at the time I didn't know what to do with it. I was 22 and just like kind of freaked out and overwhelmed by the whole experience. But I was like, you know, because this, now I understand them. I wish I could go back and be like, I know you now, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I had this impulse to call, especially a former roommate of mine in Boston when I was at Harvard. She had lost her dad as a teenager. And I like got on the phone and was telling her that I understood her better. And she was just like, what? I had this impulse to sort of be like, I'm in your group now. I get it, you know?
Yeah.
And that was kind of a supportive feeling, actually. It's like you're part of a community of mourners and we're all going to be in it. So, you know, now I'm in it.
Yeah. I mean, there are Buddhist parables that speak to that. I remember hearing one about a woman who had lost her child, a very small child, and she was hysterical with grief. So the Buddha said, go get a grain of rice from a household where nobody's ever died.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes from door to door to door to door to door.
Yeah.
There wasn't one.
Yeah.
And then her mind was calm by the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking to Emily Rapp about her book, The Still Point of the Turning World. Now, one of the things that also is very interesting in this book is, well, first of all, as you said at the beginning, you learned more about how to care for your child from other mothers than from the healthcare system. But also within the healthcare system, the people who really got who you were and what you were going through was not the regular doctors, it was the hospice doctors. And nurses.
It was such a different experience to go from a traditional doctor or a neurologist. Most of the medical community is sort of intent on saving life, which makes sense. It's not that I disagree with that. But when you go into a hospice office or whatever and you talk to the nurses, you're meeting with people who see people die all the time and know that it's a process that's the end part of life. So it's linked to life, and it's a kind of unraveling is how they describe it, or an unbinding. And the energy was just so different. It was just so very calm, and nobody like sort of freaked out when we were like, our child is, you know, we had this baby with us, this sort of normal baby. It was 9 months old, sort of giggling, and we, you know, terminally ill baby like on the table, and no one was sort of hysterical.
Right.
And it was such a relief. Because most of the time when you tell someone you have a terminally ill child, they, for good reason, just don't, are sort of stunned into silence, or they try to say like something and they don't know what to say. And it's just, everyone feels awkward. But with the hospice people, it was just like, yep, what can we do to make him comfortable? You know, death is a part of life. And I was just like, oh, you know, such a relief. And I was just, I mean, I burst into tears. It's the part of the book. I was just like, thank you. I'm so glad that we chose to go this route rather than grasp at his life with every medical intervention that could possibly be invented.
They do those?
I think that Ronan is the only baby now who that we're not doing a feeding tube. We've decided not to do that, his father and I. And I think we're the only family at the moment that's not doing intervention. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I think we're taught in this country that you must save life and prolong life, or else you failed somehow to do everything you could. People don't want to have a discussion about quality of life, because then people get upset about whether or not you're saying someone is more valuable than another person. So no one has any kind of nuanced discussions about what that might mean. And some people do it for what they say are religious reasons. So I don't judge people who do those life extending interventions, only because it's such a hideous decision and you are charged with your child's care. And if that's what you think is best for your child, great. And National TASACS, the organization that I'm involved with, no one judges. If you don't want to use a feeding tube, then they match you up with somebody who also made that choice. If you do, then you're matched up with someone who made that choice. And nobody ever says anything like, oh, how could you do that? Or I can't believe you're not doing that. It's totally judgment free. And I think it's pretty remarkable. It's like the only parenting group I've actually ever liked being a part of, because there's no competition.
Right.
It's just about support.
Right, right.
And humans, you know?
Now, Tay-Sachs disease is very rare, and only, 10 or 20 children a year are born with it, mm-hmm. which means that in the whole country, there's only a few hundred parents who've ever had kids who have this disease.
Yeah, there are about 50 kids right now living with the disease, or an allied disorder, which is similar to Tay-Sachs with the same end result, but slightly different sort of permutations. Yes, it is incredibly rare. What I will say is that most of the parents that I have become close with lost their children between 10 and 15 years ago. So the network of, especially the moms, is incredibly strong, and people stay in the organization forever.
Just to provide support.
They're really passionate. A lot of them have become hospice care workers or volunteers. They help organize the conference. They run sessions at the conference for new families who are sort of in the throes of those first grief stricken months. So yeah, I think it's a very close community. So the conferences, the family conferences, are relatively large in terms of people having gone for 20 years now or continuing to go. Last year, a woman who lost her child in 1973 was at her very first conference. And she never was really hooked up with National Tay-Sachs, but she came because, you know, she still mourns her son. And she was there and lit a candle in his honor and connected with other parents. And so, you know, it's an incredibly special community.
Now, in the book, I mean, you talk about the wonderful support you get from your friends, and you do have there's a whole, which we can't go into now because we don't have enough time, but there's a whole contemplation about what is luck. Am I lucky, and what does luck even mean? And people have to read the book to get more about that. But you do have a lot of love and support in your life, but you also have people who say stupid things.
Yeah.
And this has been going on since you were kid, because you lost you lost a foot when you were
that's right.
4 years old. So
yeah.
And they've been saying stupid stuff since you were 4 years old.
Yeah.
What kind of, and this is really for people who are listening, maybe, here's what not to say.
I think what not to say is the thing that someone said this once to me in Trader Joe's and did not appreciate my hysterical response, which was, if I were you, I would die.
Yeah.
And I just thought, really? Is that really? Is that what I should do? I was just, that's what I asked. I was like, what? What? You know, she was just like, okay, I'm leaving you. I think "you can't imagine" is a really hard one for me, because it makes me feel like, what I think it is, actually, and it makes sense, it's a distancing maneuver. It's saying,
somebody
like,
saying, I can't imagine.
Sorry for you. I'm so sorry. Pity and empathy are two different reactions. And empathy implicates the person speaking, saying like, wow, that sounds really difficult, I'm thinking about you.
Yeah.
That's actually a really witnessing kind of supportive thing to say. To say, I can't imagine, I don't know how you do it, is to put someone on a pedestal, which is to distance them, which is to say, if I'm a good enough person and I try hard enough, that won't happen to me if I'm lucky. There's no such thing as luck. There's just things that happen. So I think that was, for me, that was a huge learning curve that I, again, didn't really want to learn at all. People say, you know, I'm so blessed, I'm so lucky. I think it's great to sort of look around and be like, look at all these great things in my life. But to not attach some kind of, you've earned it or not earned it, or someone has bestowed this unknowable grace on you.
Yeah.
I think it's a dangerous game, and it sort of creates this cause and effect that doesn't exist. There's a great book that I talk about in the book, Harold Kushner's, you know, classic, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. You know, things just happen to people. And it doesn't mean if you're bad or you're good, and who even knows what those distinctions mean.
Exactly.
So I do feel like just saying I couldn't do what you do does make me feel isolated. And actually most of the time I don't feel isolated. But people who, and like what I talk about with my friends, who just kind of show up and call and text and are just right up in my business, make me feel like I can call and swail and cry, and no one's going to try to fix it. They're just going to listen. And I think I am so grateful to my friends. Am I lucky? I don't know. I mean, yes. And also no, because I don't think luck exists.
Emily Rapp is a writer and teacher. Her new book, which is coming out in the spring, is called The Still Point of the Turning World. And she will be at an event this Saturday, September 22nd, from 2 to 5 at Back Road Pizza. It's an event with a silent auction and live music, and it is a benefit for families with little or no health insurance whose children have Tay-Sachs disease or similar illnesses, and it'll help them to support their kids. And also, some of the people who are beneficiaries of this will be able to go to the national conference.
Yes, that's right.
In the spring.
Yes, very important. A lot of these families do feel very isolated. A lot of them, you know, a lot of people right now in this country don't have jobs, and that happens to kids or families that have terminally ill kids too. And they're struggling, and the insurance companies are giving them pushback, and they need the help. And also it's really important for them to be able to come every year to the national conference and meet other parents who've been through what they've been through.
For more information on Tay-Sachs disease, you can go to ntsad.org. You can also go to emilyrapp.com. And Rapp has two P's. Emily, once again, thank you so much for being with us.
I really appreciate it.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Janet Davidson. She is director of the play Love, Loss, and What I Wore, a tribute to Nora Ephron, which opens this Saturday, the 22nd of September, at the Santa Fe Playhouse. And Elena Zachary, who is one of the actors in this play. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
So Nora Ephron and her sister Delia Ephron, based on the book by Eileen Beckerman, and Nora Ephron, famous for writing Meg Ryan movies and other movies like Sleepless in Seattle and When Harry Met Sally and things like that. And this is really a play about clothing.
It's about our emotional connection, I think, to clothing.
I actually think they're life stories that are just brought to the stage by references to clothing or articles of accessories, or it's an accessory, a handbag or something like that. But I really think they're life stories.
And so you've got five women on stage acting different parts, and the structure of it, not the content, but the way it was performed, reminded me kind of the vagina monologues, because different actors play different, completely different parts in the play, and some of them are dialogues with each other, and a lot of them are monologues. And now, are these all taken from true stories? Did Eileen Beckerman go and collect stories from various American women about their relationship to clothing?
It was, as I understand it, it was largely about her life, and then it was exploded by the Ephron sisters. I saw interviews with Delia and Nora talking about their mother, who was a writer, and influenced them greatly about what they wore. So the stories are enhanced by the Ephron sisters' own direct experience as well.
Right.
And that's why when we do the show, and prior to the show, we're asking Santa Fe women and men to write up a little tiny story about something that they remember in their life and drop it off at the Playhouse, or send it to the Playhouse email, or bring it to the show, even better. And we'll read one each night from the stage about our local people, and then we'll save them, because who knows, we might end up doing Santa Fe, Love, Loss, and What I Wore.
And Janet has asked her actors as well to each write one short reminiscence about a very important article of clothing that we will end the reading with.
Yeah, or about the point in the life and what the clothing meant. Because I know each one of us has taken some really important, or almost maybe sometimes not important, but boy, it's stuck. I know Debriana's, I think hers is going to be pretty funny because it really stuck in her life.
And what's marvelous in talking about this project, Love, Loss, and What I Wore, is the conversations that it engenders among women. If we say, for a woman, do you remember getting your first bra? Everybody immediately zeroes in on that experience, for good or for ill. And that's part of the charm, I think, and in some cases, real poignancy about these stories that are narrated, you know, through the play.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's one of the monologues is about, and it's one of the funniest ones, I think, is about women's purses. And when I was with Stu yesterday on the radio on KSFR, without even knowing that there was something in there about purses, he said, oh boy, the one thing, because he said, is there anything here for men? He said, can I learn something about my wife? He said, the one thing I won't touch is her purse. I won't go in there. It's a landmine in there. So I think a lot of men know that. I've had men when I've said, would you go into my purse and get my wallet? And they hand me the whole purse because they do not want to go into my purse.
Well, there are... how should we say this on the radio? There are sort of supposedly Freudian implications of purses, and opening a purse is like a sexual opening.
Oh!
yeah, and I think if you think about it, and if you think about the different kinds of... Look at what purse you have, and look at the purses of your friends, and how big and small they are, and whether they're neatly organized or not. And they actually do say a lot about a person.
We could talk about the purses that Janet and I have brought to this interview, and whatever purse you have, they're emblematic, I think, of who we are right at this moment.
Right.
I know. I have a smaller purse, and I can't get enough into it. I have a bigger purse, and I can't find anything. And that's what this wonderful monologue goes on about. And no matter what you do, it's not quite right.
And this is the thing. I watched the rehearsal of this, and I thought, do American women really, are we really that shallow? Do we really put that much of our emotional energy and our sense of self-esteem into our clothing and into what that clothing means? And I found it kind of, I was a little bit depressed about that.
But see, now I have a different perspective because I'm looking at the emotional content. You know, I can look at certain moments in my life, the way Janet's, you know, having us focus, or I could look at certain articles of clothing that come up that have tremendous emotional content. The selection of the dress for my mother's passing, my mother's funeral. A very romantic night in Negril, Jamaica in 1982. I remember exactly what I wore. So to me, that is the fun of these explorations, you know, these monologues and these dialogues. It's the emotional content that really makes it sing for me.
I also think it's a wonderful leaping point for discussion, because I think that's what's so fascinating, is that right here this morning we've had an off-air wonderful discussion about our lives and the various things we think about our bodies and how people's reactions to our bodies and to maybe what we wore or clothed it or whatever. I find clothing can be enormously creative and really can say something about who we are. I mean, I was saying before is that I have walls in my house, and those walls are perfectly sturdy and perfectly fine, but I have artwork up on the walls because I enjoy it. I enjoy the creativity, and I enjoy looking at it. And sometimes when I've got an outfit on that just makes me feel good, it's comfortable, and it makes me feel good, and people will stop me and say, oh, you look so pretty. And it may not be the outfit that's pretty, but I just feel good in it, so I kind of glow a little more. And I think that's a lot of what clothing can do when we think of it as creativity. And I think that's what's exciting about it. And I think the conversation that it evokes. There's a whole little piece about shoes and about the Birkenstocks, how the girl goes from high heels to Birkenstocks and then eventually back to high heels again.
And I get home from an event where I've dressed up and I look nice, and I can't wait to get out of it.
Oh, I think we all can't wait to get out of it. I don't think we stand it at home. But that moment in time when you just feel good, you know, I don't know. That first sip of wine is pretty good. Maybe the third one is too much.
I was thinking that, you know, as I began to prepare working with Janet on this, so many memories started to surface about articles of clothing that were so important. And, of course, I wouldn't have thought about them had I not been preparing the script for Janet. And one of the pieces that I'm hoping that I'll be able to contribute, when I was in sixth grade, I wanted nothing more than to be an ice skating star. I was in love with Sonia Henie movies and ice capades, and we had a pond behind the house. I spent every possible free moment skating, and I had dreams about seeing myself as a little skating star. Now, bear in mind, I was built like a turnip, and I was also small. There was no hope for this. And still in all, my family...
What are turnips built like?
Well, they're not long. You don't think of turnips as long and lean. If I say a fire plug, maybe that's a more apt analogy. That was my body type when I was in sixth grade. But our family joined the Cleveland Arena, and I got to take skating lessons. And I fulfilled a lifelong dream, lifelong up to sixth grade, getting to be in the year-end ice skating show. And my mother had to make the costume because all the moms did. I was a skating mushroom. Okay, was it glamorous? You betcha. And that, you know, that yellow flannel spangled onesie with a coolie hat was my ice skating debut outfit. Who could ever forget a moment like that?
I think one of the things that probably Alana and I grew up differently with is the fact that our mothers sewed. I know my mother sewed. And in those days,
a lot of mothers
made their own clothing. Mm-hmm. My first real wonderful interaction with my mom in a lot of ways was making doll clothes with her. And I had these dolls, and we would make the doll clothes together. I still have a bunch of doll clothes because little girls love dressing their dolls up. And that's a missing element. My mother used to make her clothes, and we were talking yesterday, I think, about the fact that it's really, clothes can be so cheap now that it's almost not something you want to sit at home and make anymore.
Well, it actually costs more to go to the fabric store and buy a pattern, thread, zippers, mm-hmm. buttons, and fabric than it does to go buy clothing, which is often petroleum-based and sweatshop-made.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But that relationship between the mother and the daughter of sitting around after school and kind of putting those things together is something I cherish. I remember it and I cherish it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm not so sure that exists the same way anymore.
My character that I principally play, Gingy, talks a lot about that. Her mother made most of her clothing, and it was economic. And she said, they were wonderful and I love them. I really longed for a store-bought outfit. So she talks a little bit about an important store-bought outfit. It's a culture, and things have changed. My mother also. We all grew up learning how to sew. Yeah. We made Ginny Doll. Do you remember Ginny Doll?
I have them at home still.
And I would buy doll pat. Well, it's because we're older than you are, Mary Shelley. But I bought patterns to make doll clothes. If I had remnants, it was a thing of the times that you did.
Mm-hmm. It was just as if you came home and you drew and you made artwork, you put that together. It'd be like you put something in, you put a little skirt on the... No, that doesn't work, and then you put something in. It was a form of creativity that was really kind of wonderful.
We're talking about the play Love, Loss, and What I Wore. It's a tribute to Nora Ephron. And one of the things that you're doing is collecting articles of clothing for Esperanza Shelter.
We thought it'd be a great idea because as Americans, we all have so much more than we need, that if we brought in outfits to contribute, wouldn't that be a wonderful way of acknowledging the generosity that we have? And also that, to me, that emotional connection we have to outfits, to help somebody else out of our surplus, out of our excess.
Yes, and I know my friend who's a costume designer in Los Angeles was very involved with Dress for Success, where they brought very specific things for women who were ready to re-enter the workforce and send them off. And it just, she said you could see the difference when they put a suit on that really fit well, that they could go into an interview with that, and they felt so much more confident because their lives had been totally shaken, and is the same as the women and the families that are in Esperanza. Their lives are uprooted, and sometimes they come with nothing. So if we can put something on them that isn't just a hand-me-down kind of thing, but a nice outfit, something that really, okay, I feel good in this.
Now, you've got some wonderful cast members. Besides Elena Zachary, there's Sheridan Johnson, Jenny Gabriel, Joya Berlin, and Debriana Mancini. And it's a very, very strong cast.
It's a wonderful cast. I feel totally blessed. you know, I could visualize this. I knew who I wanted. And although Sheridan is new to me, and I thank Elena for that.
she was in Midsummer Night's Dream.
She was in Midsummer Night's Dream, yeah. She is someone to watch.
She's
electrifying on stage.
But my chance to work with the others again, and quite a lot of them, both Jenny and Debriana, are very film people. And since my whole career has really been in film, since I gave up stage years ago, it's fun to work with them again. It really is. I'm having a ball. They're so good. Sometimes I forget to write notes down. I'm like just watching them, and I had a note there. What was it? I don't remember.
You know, and as an actor, it's so much fun for me because we've got this great span of ages, and it's like a hen party when we get together because we keep having these conversations. And I also marvel at the gifts of these women bringing to bear on these fantastic monologues.
Yes, and although it's a staged reading, I'm trying to put some little things into it that are a little more than just reading the script, and many are not going to be just reading.
But
also,
we need to have people understand it has always been a stage reading. When it ran off Broadway for all those years, there were women sitting behind music stands, and that's what they did. So it's not a play in that sense.
Do they change their clothes?
No. Yeah. No. What we're going to do a little bit of that, but we're not changing. We'll just have a reveal in the end. It's actually the reason I found this play is that I was looking at, and I saw the title, and then I realized that Tyne Daly had opened in it, and I think she came back to close it, and she played it in Los Angeles too. And so that somehow, even though I didn't know Nora Ephron, I probably was in the same room with her at some point in my career. That would be 800 people and I. but Tyne was the first major actress I directed in Los Angeles, and she just happened to be one of the last ones I directed before I came here. So I felt that there was a one degree of separation there, and I really wanted to do that. I wanted to honor a woman, Nora Ephron, who has done an enormous amount for women in the film industry by just being consistently good. You may not love what she did, but the bottom line is her films, both the ones she directed and the ones she wrote, in terms of Hollywood, they're huge grocers.
And you've got Mail, Julie and Julia, yes. Sleepless in Seattle, When Harry Met Sally, Silkwood.
Heartburn. I mean, these are
Bewitched.
Big moneymakers.
Yeah.
And that's the way Hollywood equates success. That's the bottom line for them. And women don't usually get into that category. So the fact that Nora was consistently in that category, I don't want to give her a tribute because she was a moneymaker, but I want to give her a tribute for how dedicated she was to keep putting things in front of us that were so relatable on the human level. I mean, her book of I Hate My Neck, I got to tell you, there's a lot of women out there that hate their necks.
And also the play that she wrote with Delia, How to Eat Like a Child. She told women's stories, you know, many different women, many different stories, and continues, obviously, to live through her films and through Love, Loss, and What I Wore.
Love, Loss, and What I Wore opens this Saturday, September 22nd at 7:30 at the Santa Fe Playhouse, and it's also Sunday at 4 o'clock, Sunday the 23rd of September. There's a suggested donation, so you can call 988-4262 for reservations. You can also write to Playhouse at santafeplayhouse.org. Janet Davidson is the director, and Elena Warren Zachary is one of the actors in Love, Loss, and What I Wore, a tribute to Nora Ephron. Thank you so much, ladies, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.